Hello, everyone. Let's see, we have a few Zoomers and maybe a few YouTubers. So welcome. Hope you had a good week and a good week of meditation. I actually had an idea, but it kind of died on the vine because it's always nice to meditate with other people. So I was going to work it out with Aaron, where at 6:30 or 6:45, we'd open up the Zoom, and anybody who wanted to come and meditate with me, because or Aaron, we were going to swap off. We could all meditate together, but it didn't happen. Maybe in the future, we can use technology to be together when we're not together. So anyway, just before I just launch into these prayers again, this is these are traditional prayers, and I don't expect it to mean a lot to you, but just saying the words, we're planting seeds, and maybe there'll come times in the future when maybe you will have an opportunity to study more deeply meanings of these prayers. But it's just a way of grounding us, and it sort of helps to set the motivation in a positive way instead of something neutral. And we'll talk a little bit more about motivation later on, but let's just start out by doing refuge and bodhicitta. Now, I can't hear everybody, so it's okay. You probably, if you want to turn your mute off and you want, it doesn't matter, but I'm just going to do it. And one of the things that I'm going to add that we don't usually do, but you can do, is visualize in the space in front of you at the level of your forehead and a body's length in front is this, this throne with a lotus, a sun, and a moon seat. And on top of that is the Buddha, the fully enlightened being, the Buddha, like a hologram, completely made of light. And, he's got a begging bowl in his left hand, and his right hand is in the earth-touching mudra. And he's got his eyes are just slightly open, and he has a real sort of nice smile on his face, very contented smile. And so if we can imagine that as we're saying the prayers, and again, this may be more than you can bite off, but if you can imagine as you're saying the prayers that rainbow light and nectar come from the heart of the Buddha and enter your body, maybe through the crown of your head. We can make this visualization more complex, but I think this is just the easiest way to do it. Rainbow light and nectar come in as we say the prayers, and just completely fills our body with this pure energy. Okay, so traditionally when we do the prayers, we hold our hands together, so I'm going to do that. And we hold it at our heart also. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. Remember, we said that's the definition of love. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, which is the definition of compassion. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. That's sort of the key message, is joy. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So, and that has to do with equanimous state of mind. So these are four measurable states of mind: love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then, again, you know, I think in, you know, back in the day, whenever someone would, you know, back when, in the early days of Buddhism, when it was, the teachings, I think, were seen as much more precious than they are now. But a student or a group of students would go to a teacher and make offerings of all kinds of precious stones and maybe gold or whatever. And you know, it's sort of like the point of it is not that the teacher needed it, but it was the way of the student showing how committed they were to getting the teachings and practicing them. It was kind of a statement of their sincerity, is the fact that they would make these kinds of offerings. So here we're offering like everything, the entire universe, to the enlightened being, to the Buddha, to be able to receive the teachings. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, imagine this as a Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandala Kamnir Yata Yami, which means I offer this precious mandala to you precious gurus. So now, we've kind of set the tone. So let's start out by doing a few minutes of following the breath, and you can pick it any place you want to follow it. A lot of people choose the sensation at the tip of the nose, but it could be rising and falling of the chest or abdomen. But I want you to follow the breath. And if you, the last time we counted, like, out and in was one, out and in was two. So if you find that helpful, you can do that. If you find that a distraction, then just do the breathing meditation. And when your mind is distracted, which inevitably it will be, and it could be, you know, in the course of a 20-minute meditation, you might be distracted 200 times. Could be. You just keep coming back. You just keep coming back to the breath. So it's not a competition. It's just every time that you are aware that your mind has gone off and you bring it back, that's actually the practice. That's strengthening the muscle of mindfulness. So let's do this for, say, 10 minutes. mind is distracted, and as inevitably it will be, you just bring the mind back to the experience of breathing. Your your contract with yourself is to stay focused on the breath. And remember, you may have to come back in the course of a 10-minute meditation. You may be distracted many, many times. That is part of the practice. We're beginners, and so we just bring the mind back gently and firmly and affix our attention to the experience of the breathing, whether it be at the sensation at the tip of the nose or the rising and falling of the abdomen or chest. That's my timer. Just to check in with those of you out there, how was your week? Your week of meditation? Anybody have any unusual experiences or any problems? Anything? Not that I can answer them, but I can try. So yeah, just. Whatever happened this last week, good or bad, did anybody levitate? That'd be a nice thing.
And if, feel free to unmute and share.
This is Joy. I really liked the Thubten Chodron guided meditations. I thought those were pretty wonderful.
Yeah. And which one, was there any one particular that you liked?
Well, yes, I did jump ahead. I know like we were going to do them kind of in order, but there was a purification one. Uh-huh. And I think it was Lama Zopa who said that if like anybody who doesn't do a purification meditation every day is like loco, you know, like it's like it's the thing to do, you know. And that particular meditation really was wonderful.
I'm trying to remember. Was it the Vajrasattva practice?
Oh, I don't know if it's called that. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't know if it was called that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I did do it every day.
The four appointed powers. That's what it was.
Yes. It was.
What's the source of these guided meditations?
It's called Guided Meditations. It's on Shambhala Publication.
Oh, the book you mentioned last week.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
All the guided meditations are, I basically took it and put it on my phone as an app, and I just open it up and use it in the morning. And I love I've known her for a long time. At first I was listening to her voice and I went, I couldn't get into it. And then the more and more I listen, she's a great teacher. And she basically lives in Washington State. She started an abbey called Sarvasti Abbey in the mountains of Washington State. She used to come to Kadapa Center and teach, probably 3 or 4 times, 5 times maybe. But she doesn't stray too far from Washington these days. But she's a great teacher. So anything else? Any other comments? Any problems anybody had? Obstacles?
Don.
No obstacles.
Sometimes I get distracted because I feel like I'm not breathing. And I get to the point I'm like, oh, I don't feel like I'm breathing. And then I'm distracted by the thought of, instead of being distracted by random thoughts, I'm distracted by, feeling like I'm not breathing enough during it, or I'm going to suffocate myself.
Interesting. I mean, we all know, excuse me. Like when we breathe really fast, like when we're excited, we tend to breathe faster, right? And when we're calmer, our breathing tends to slow down. And in developing calm abiding, for example, there may be a time when your breath is so subtle that you lose it. You cannot perceive your breathing at all. It's like so subtle. And then you have to use a visualized object to focus on because you can't perceive the breathing anymore. But that is not a rare experience. That became a distraction for you. And it's, again, you just notice that and go back to the practice. And that's okay. That was interesting, though, that your breath got that subtle. Did you have any kind of physical experience along with it?
Not really. Just the thought that, like, I just felt like I didn't have any breath.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I was not focusing on my object but anyway, I was just like, that's nothing to worry about.
No.
Just try to go back to the object. The object isn't, I'm not going to die from not breathing.
Hopefully not. I guess it'll be... Yeah.
Depending on how much you not breathe.
That's good. Any other pressing questions before we move on? No? Okay. So, I've been a couple of thoughts that I've been looking at. I want to know how many people actually did five. I mean, I know I can't see their hands, but I'm just curious how many people actually meditated at least five times this past week. Is there any way to know that?
There's a little thing right here. It says reaction.
Oh, and you can hit reaction.
Raise hand.
And raise your hand. Oh, good. Let's see how many hands go up.
And Don, you can also, up in your right upper corner, there should be a button that says view. And you can put your view in gallery view to be able to see everyone.
Let me see.
So it's upper right corner.
Yeah.
There's a little thing that says view. And then if you click on it, it gives you the option of speaker view or gallery view.
Uh-huh.
Hi, I'm Lily.
Oh, yes. You have a teenager there that can help you with this. And you'll want to put it in gallery view.
That's good.
That will enable you
to
see everyone.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Who is that? Annabelle? That's Lily?
That's Lillian.
Hannah?
Lillian. She just dropped in.
Awesome.
She wasn't coming, but then she came anyway.
Well, it's good to see you.
So anyway, that's good. But you know, there's you know, we make commitments all the time, don't we? But the thing that, you know, for example, we set the motivation today of doing this practice, being here, in order to become enlightened, to liberate all sentient beings. That's bodhicitta, right? That's the Mahayana motive that we strive to cultivate. Now I'm going to say this right off the bat. That doesn't get me out of bed in the morning. I don't think it gets many people out of bed in the morning. I think we need to drill down a little deeper than getting enlightened, which is something that I'm going to say most of us, I can't speak for everybody, but I think I can. I don't think any of us think we have that potential. So getting enlightened for all sentient beings and to guide them to enlightenment, that's the motivation. That is the Mahayana motivation. That's the motivation of a bodhisattva, a really advanced spiritual warrior. But that most of us are beginners. So we have to drill down a little deeper and come up with a motivation that works for us. And it has to be real. It has to be real for you. For example, right now, you may be dealing with family issues, or you may have problems at work, or you may have health issues that are difficult for you to accept, and so on. So I think it's really important for us in the beginning to be real about our motivation and to think, you know, what can we, you know, this meditation practice, you know, what do I really want to get out of it today, tomorrow, next week? Down the road, yeah, I would love to get enlightened. I would love to be able to guide all suffering sentient beings to supreme enlightenment. Wouldn't that be just great? But right now, sometimes, I mean, to really get it together, I think we need to make it real for us. If you have family problems, if you have issues with health or work or whatever it is that is on your mind, that can be part of your motivation too. It should be really maybe the focus. I got this magazine some years ago. It's actually Scientific American. And this one, This one goes back to 2014. Okay. And if I don't know if you can still, I mean, you might be able to find it. You probably can get it. It's online. But there's a nice section in here on meditation. And some of the claims, and I'm not going to read too much, but just a little bit. Got to watch my time here. But it says, for example, compassion's a big deal in Tibetan Buddhism. It's like the big deal. So to generate a compassionate state, I'm just reading directly from the article, may sometimes entail the meditative feeling what another person is feeling. But having one's emotions resonate empathetically with the feelings of another person does not by itself suffice to yield a compassionate mindset. In other words, empathizing with others doesn't necessarily cause compassion to arise. The meditation must also be driven by an unselfish desire to help someone who's suffering. This form of meditation on love and compassion has proved to be more than just a spiritual exercise. It has shown potential to benefit healthcare workers, teachers, and others who run the risk of emotional burnout linked to the distress experienced from a deeply empathetic reaction to another person's plight. And it goes on to say, the meditator begins, and we'll do this in just a minute, but the meditator begins by focusing on an unconditional feeling of benevolence or love for others, accompanied by the silent repetition of a phrase conveying intent, such as, may all beings find happiness and the causes of happiness. Remember, we said that's love. And be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So again, may all beings, and we could do this just right now for 2 minutes. We'll do a 2-minute meditation. And we're going to say silently to ourselves, may all beings find happiness and the causes of happiness and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So one of the thoughts when I think about this particular meditation that they're describing, it's like when we talk about developing compassion in Buddhism, you have to start out with an equanimous mind. You can't, maybe when you say all beings, that may not evoke anything in your heart. You know, because it sounds so, it doesn't, you know, it's hard to wrap our mind around all beings. We don't know all beings, but we can, usually when we do a practice like this, and there's one, this is sort of like Tonglen, or, which is taking actually giving and taking, where you give love and you take suffering. You imagine mentally doing that. It works. I think usually we try to start out with ourselves. We start out with imagining ourselves. May I have happiness and the causes of happiness. And may I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Again, silently. You can, and we're talking about your future. May in the future, because the past is gone, right? Can't change that. But in your future, may I have happiness and the causes of happiness. And may I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And then you can expand that to somebody else, somebody in your family that you, or some loved one, and you think of them. Because, again, if you don't care about somebody, if you don't love them or feel some strong emotion, their suffering could actually make you happy if you hate them, right? So you have, for compassion to arise, there has to be more than just a casual acquaintance. There has to be a genuine feeling of affection. So again, think of somebody in your family or somebody, loved one, and think, may they have happiness and the causes of happiness, and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And you might even think about what suffering and they might be experiencing now, or what they want and need, and you can imagine offering that to them when you wish them happiness and the causes of happiness. So let's do that for a minute. This is where we're focusing on a loved one. And you can link it to the breath. So as you breathe out, you're breathing out happiness and the causes of happiness. And as you're breathing in their suffering and the causes of suffering. But it's not going to make you sick. Not going to make you sick. And now we could actually expand that to include like all these universal living beings that are strangers that we don't really know well or know at all. But one thing we do know about them, they're very intimate, is that they all want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. Let's wish them, imagine you're surrounded by universal living beings, and wish them, may you have happiness and the causes of happiness, and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And again, you can use your breath to help with this practice, breathing out love, breathing in compassion. Okay, now just relax your attention. I mean, this is such a cool practice. You can do it when you're standing, you're in an elevator, or when you're standing in front of somebody that you just met, they don't know what you're thinking, you know. But if for a moment you think, you know, may you have happiness in the cause of happiness. Obviously, you're saying it silently to yourself. And may you be free of suffering and its causes. Yeah, may you have happiness in its causes and be free of suffering in its causes. You can practice this all day long if you're mindful. So many opportunities to sort of cultivate this mind of love and compassion. I think one of the, Thupten Pinda, who's a former monk, and for like 20 years, I asked him, I said, what practice in all of Buddhism, day to day, day in and day out, do you find most helpful? And he said, just this very one. Whenever, for example, his mind is a little bit stressed or in a negative space, he will he'll wish himself happiness and the causes of happiness. You know, may I be happy and have the causes of happiness, and may I be free of, let's say he's angry. May I be free of anger and the causes of anger. May I have patience and tolerance and happiness, and may I be free of anger. And so using whatever delusional state of mind he's experiencing at that moment, using that as an opportunity to develop love and compassion for himself. I thought that was very interesting, and I've tried to do it over the years. I'm not very good at remembering to do it, but whenever you're struggling, just stop for a moment and send yourself, you know, energy of, May I be free of suffering. I mean, may I have happiness and its causes, and may I be free of suffering and its causes. So, very cool practice. So let me read on here, because this is this gets into something kind of juicy. In 2008, we studied experienced volunteers who practiced this form of training for thousands of hours and found an increase in the activity in several brain regions while they listened to voices conveying distress. The secondary, I'm not going to read all these different parts of the brain because it just bewilders people. But anyway, the secondary somatosensory and insular cortices of the brain, known to participate in empathetic and other emotional responses, were more activated for experts than controls in response to distress voice, suggesting an enhanced ability to share the feelings of others without reporting any sign of becoming emotionally overwhelmed. The practice of compassion meditation also produced more activity in such areas as the temporoparietal junction and the blah, 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 different aspects of the brain. They were doing PET scans on these meditators. And then this, just one more paragraph, one or two more paragraphs. More recently, a couple of investigators, both at the Max Planck Institute of Human Cognitive and Brain Science in Germany, in collaboration with this group in Madison, Wisconsin, sought to distinguish the difference between the effects of empathy and compassion on meditators. Now, some people, this might rub you wrong, but I'm just reading. Don't kill the messenger. But they wanted to see if there was a difference between empathy and compassion. They noted that compassion and altruistic love were associated with positive emotions, and they suggested that emotional exhaustion or burnout was, in fact, a kind of empathy fatigue. Let me say that again. They noted that compassion and altruistic love were associated with positive emotions and suggested that emotional exhaustion or burnout was in fact a kind of empathy fatigue. According to the Buddhist contemplative tradition from which this practice is derived, compassion, far from leading to distress and discouragement, reinforces inner balance, strength of mind, and courageous determination to help those who suffer. If a child is hospitalized, the presence of a loving mother at his side, holding his hand and comforting him with tender words, will no doubt do that child more good than the anxiety of a mother overwhelmed with empathetic distress who's unable to bear the sight of her sick child, paces back and forth in the hallway. In the latter case, the mother may then end up with the common experience of burnout, which in a one U.S. study, beset about 60% of 600 caregivers surveyed. That's pretty wild. So they're making a distinction between empathy, which sometimes I used to use the word empathy interchangeably with compassion, but I think if we look up the word empathy, I think it means kind of feeling with. And the way we're using compassion here is more active. It's not only associated with love, but it's also associated with, you know, this wish that they be free of suffering. There's a more active component in it, I guess, is the way I would say it. And so, we all know and have experienced probably empathy where we were overwhelmed by our emotions. And they're saying that, in essence, if we experience compassion, our mind just gets happier and happier. But maybe, just maybe, empathy, the way they're describing it here, is a problem. And they go on, I'm not going to read everything, but they did another study where they compared people who were trained to do this compassion meditation and another group who were trained to do this empathy meditation. And they found the compassionate people, when they tested them, their mind was more uplifted by the experience. And the people who were trained in empathy were more sort of like, it was a downer. And then they took the people who'd been trained to be empathetic and trained them in the compassionate practice that we just did. And they shifted. And their negative sort of despondent, whatever their mind was that was not happy, shifted to a more positive state of mind when they meditated on compassion. So it's really important to make that distinction. I'm inviting you to just take a look at it. See if you agree. If you do, great. If you don't, then we can discuss it. And you can talk about it with people. I think it's a really good talking point. All right. So, they went on to say, researchers, moreover, were able to demonstrate that a week of training in compassion increased pro-social behavior in a virtual game specifically developed to measure the capacity to help others. Let me read that again. These researchers were able to demonstrate that a week of training in compassion increased pro-social behavior in a virtual game specifically developed to measure the capacity to help others. And then the articles go on to talk about how, you know, meditators that have been doing it for a while, even the cortex, the cerebral cortex, is thicker and controls older people, older individuals who might, I mean, if you do CAT scans or MRIs in older people, you'll start noticing that the cerebral cortex shrinks. But they saw a difference in meditators, that the cerebral cortex did not shrink as much, or in fact, seemed to be expanded. So there's some, I mean, they're making some claims, some suggestions that there's an association with meditation on compassion, for example, and maybe a delay in our dementia, or at least our cognitive decline. Even talk about telomeres and these little telomeres that when they get shorter and shorter, we get older and older. And, helping us in that way, you can lengthen telomeres through meditation. So this was a pretty in-depth science article, but I like science, and it gives me it helps me motivate myself to, it gives me some confidence that meditation practice is actually backed up by science. I think more and more we're seeing that, and people like that. Any comments or questions about what I've said so far?
Even tonight on the news, before I joined the, opened the Zoom call, can't remember if it was WRAL or CNN, but they had a science person on talking about meditation and how that will help with actually Zoom fatigue, and how so many people have Zoom fatigue sitting in front of a computer and going from meeting to meeting and not being able to process things in between and have downtime. And they recommended meditation as well.
Yeah. And the kind of meditation that we're doing, this single pointed, the kind of meditation that Thupten Chodron was guiding us through is what what she calls checking meditation. The Dalai Lama called it, I think he called it analytical meditation, contemplative meditation, different words like that. But it is a kind of thinking. You're thinking about things in a different way. You're trying to go a little bit deeper into a subject and to get to the essence of it. And that's different than what we did when we were following the breath, isn't it? That particular practice of single point of concentration, of being able to focus the mind on one thing, and that's not unique to Buddhism, as I mentioned last time. Hinduism, other forms of other meditative traditions all have, this practice of developing, of focusing the mind on one object and keeping it there. And to quote a friend of mine, George Dreyfus, who was a monk at one time, he's a professor at Williams College in college in Western Massachusetts. He said he was talking about this practice of single pointed concentration and how it has such a healing effect on the mind, has a calming and a healing effect on the mind. You can imagine how much of our days are spent just completely distracted and not even knowing that we're distracted. So this is a useful practice. And in Buddhism, we need both. We need both this concentration practice, and we need to be able to do the analytical practice, because eventually we need to be able to conjoin these two practices when we're analyzing reality, the deeper levels of reality. I have an ant on my computer. I'm trying to save him. Anyway.
A lucky ant. So, Gary, I see that you're unmuted. Did you have a question or want to say anything?
No. I think it was from my last comment.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Am I making breathing noises?
No. I just happened to see that you were unmuted. I thought, oh, maybe Gary has something.
No, that was from my question before.
Okay. And Sue, what about you?
I just wanted to say, that I was recently reading about a new book about brain. And one thing that the article mentioned is that when you do something with intention, the brain lights up, apparently. Your brain really likes intentionality. And I thought, the Buddha had that figured out like 2,500 years ago, and science has caught up to it. I just thought that was interesting.
Good. Yeah, I mean, and that gets back to the point, why we do the motivation at the beginning of our practice, and why your motivation has to be meaningful to you personally, not something that's eerie theory, but something that can get you up in the morning and get you on the cushion. Like I said, most people, the idea of getting enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings, not going to get you up. But if you're stressed out a lot of the time and have issues with anxiety, depression, or have, just worry, and we're all worried about our health and our family and stuff like that, you know, that's a good enough reason to go meditate, to train our mind to be calm and peaceful. I want to go over a subject, and I'm not going to take a lot of time on it, but it's called the Four Noble Truths, and that's one of the meditations that I'm pretty sure I mentioned to Linda that we want to do next time. Yeah, the Four Noble Truths is B6, but
Don, so, before you delve into that, we do have a question. Okay. And it ties back to the sympathy and empathy. Do you want to try to tackle that now or wait?
Let's wait on that.
Okay.
By the way, this is another point that's sometimes useful. You may be doing, again, in the beginning, our ability to stay focused is not much, is it? I mean, we don't need to sit for an hour. We won't get much accomplished, but sitting for shorter periods of time, like 10 minutes or 20 minutes, and really, you know, giving our mind laser-like attention, much more beneficial to try to do it that way. All right. So I'm sorry, the question again, Linda.
Well, do you want to tackle it now, or do you want to move on to what you are?
I think I want to do the Four Noble Truths.
Okay, all right.
And then we can come back. But I know what I was going to say too. When you're meditating and you have this great idea, and you just it's like you can't get it out of your mind. Write it down. Keep a notebook and a piece of paper next to you. Write it down, and then you can let it go. It's almost like journaling, but just write a note. If you come up with some brilliant idea and you're afraid you're going to forget it, write it down, then come back and do your mindfulness practice or your guided meditation practice like that. All right. So the Four Noble Truths, this is really, again, gets back to having faith. And the word faith in Buddhism gets kind of a bad rap, but it's the first thing that the Buddha ever taught when he got enlightened in Bodh Gaya, and he walked to Sarnath, which is not too far from Varanasi in India, and he taught his first group of disciples, and the first thing he taught was the truth of dukkha, which means unsatisfactoriness. It's often translated as suffering, and it's the beginning of the spiritual practice for most of us. It's like, if you don't think you have a problem, you have no motivation to practice. If you're so overwhelmed by like the God realm type mentality, I mean, things are so good and you don't recognize the problems, you won't have any motivation to practice. So the principal things that the Buddha taught when he talked about this first noble truth was he talked about the biggies like birth, sickness, aging, old age, and death. So we all have to deal with that. So he said we're all, he basically said we're all suffering. Whether we like it or whether we recognize it or not, we're all suffering. And there were three kinds of suffering that he talked about. There was obvious suffering, like depression, anxiety, broken bones, illnesses, things that anybody would recognize as suffering. Then there was another kind of, the second kind of suffering was called the suffering of change, and more difficult to recognize. And it's like, for example, if you get too hot and it's a warm day outside, and your air condition's too cold, you get uncomfortable, right? So you go outside, get out in the sun, and you go, oh, gosh, it feels so great out here. And then after you're there for about 10 or 15 minutes in the sun, then you start getting uncomfortable. It's a gradual process, you know. Gradually you get more and more and more uncomfortable until you go, I'm not having fun. It's too hot. Then you go back inside. It's like that. You know, everything that we now experience as pleasurable and literally dedicate our lives to in some way, some of us, none of us going to last. And we cling. We cling to deliciousness. We cling to having things last, and they don't last. And because of that, we suffer. Okay? So the Buddha said, don't cling. That this is the suffering of change. That everything is in a constant state of flux. Our youthfulness will disappear. You know, our health will disappear eventually. Eventually we will disappear. Right? Everything is in a constant state of not only that sort of gross change, but then the subtle change in our mind. Our mind, you know, Buddhism says in a finger snap, there are 60 mind moments in a finger snap. In other words, the mind is changing. And of course, that's just a way of describing that the mind subtly is changing constantly. So we have these gross and subtle changes of mind, and if we cling to anything, we're bound to suffer. If we cling to happiness, cling to whatever it is, we're bound to suffer. So that was the second kind. The third kind of suffering was called pervasive suffering. And it's just the mere fact that we have a body and mind. We have this body and mind that's basically part of samsara. We were born. We didn't choose to be born. Like, we've gone through all kinds of trials and tribulations, and we have no control. We have absolutely minimal control over our mind and what's going to happen tomorrow, who we're going to meet, whether we're going to be happy or sad. We live in a process of uncontrolled causation. And one of the examples of this that was kind of graphic is like having a burn on your arm. This is the Buddha saying, it's like we have a burn on our arm, and when you pour cool water over the burn, it relieves the pain and the suffering for a moment. You go, wow, that feels good. But then underneath that cool water, you know, the problems come again and again. So this is the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, that we live in a world that's unsatisfactory. Now, the Buddha wasn't trying to depress us. He was pointing this out because he's pointing out what we can get beyond. He's pointing out, and we don't have, I'm going to say most of us don't have the confidence that we can get beyond suffering. But the Buddha is saying, yes, suffering can be stopped. Because it has causes. What are the causes of suffering? They're delusions and karma. The principal delusion is ignorance, isn't it? Where we misperceive reality. You know what we know, we can think of, we call that ignorance, but there's anger and jealousy and pride. And, you know, all those negative mind states that we might, that destroy our peace of mind, destroy the peace of mind of other people. You know, all of these delusions lead to actions, and they plant seeds on the mind stream, but they also lead to not only physical and verbal actions that plant seeds that will ripen in the future as suffering. So the Buddha said, yep, we're suffering. That's dukkha, and there's a cause of suffering, which is our delusions and our karma. And then he claimed, and again, this is the Buddhist claim, that it's possible to cure this disease called dukkha by eliminating ignorance. Ignorance is like the taproot. Ignorance is misperceiving ourselves, misperceiving reality, and then and then it, you know, and distorting things and causing all kinds of problems. But if we can develop the wisdom, you know, this wisdom in Buddhism that we call seeing things as they are, seeing things as empty of inherent existence, this basic wisdom that the Buddha is talking about, if we can develop that, we can stop our suffering, completely stop it. And there's no other religious tradition that I'm aware of that claims that you can, in this lifetime, stop all of your suffering and find not only peace, but bliss, like joy and bliss and happiness beyond anything we could ever imagine. That's the claim of Buddhism. And then the fourth truth was the path. And it's packaged different ways, to use Venerable Ravina's language, you know, but it's packaged sometimes, at least in Theravada Buddhism, they say ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the three higher trainings. Training in ethics, training in concentration, and training in wisdom. And the point of ethics is, if we cannot live an ethical lifestyle, first of all, that's the beginning of mindfulness, is setting some limits on our behavior. And then when we go astray, we bring our mind back. We try to protect ourselves by living an ethical life, because if we're going around constantly full of regret, there's no way, when we try to sit and meditate, to develop any peace, any sort of real concentration practice. So again, three higher trainings are ethics and concentration. And then when we develop concentration, then when we can see reality, when we can see through the projections, see things as they are, then we can take this mind that's like a laser and penetrate reality and actually transform our mind. That's called a realization. So we have to have both concentration and wisdom to develop kinds of important realizations that will lead to this cessation of suffering called nirvana. So again, Four Noble Truths. First one is dukkha, or suffering, that all beings are experiencing that, whether they are aware of it or not. We all experience it. But, you know, because we're literally magnets for problems. Like I said, the most difficult one to see was the third one, that we are constant magnets for problems. The second truth was the cause. The third was that the claim that our suffering can be stopped, basically by developing wisdom. And then the fourth truth was the path to cessation. So again, the three higher trainings, ethics, concentration, and wisdom. In Mahayana Buddhism, a lot of times, the Lam Rim basically is the path. But also we talk about renunciation, bodhicitta, and the correct view of emptiness or wisdom. So renunciation is this determination to be free of suffering. Bodhicitta is this universal compassion, wishing all beings to be, you know, to be happy and to take responsibility for guiding them to that. And then wisdom is what's necessary to be able to do that, to develop the wisdom of emptiness. But those are different ways to talk about the path. So let's just take a couple of minutes and review this. There's a meditation that Chogyam's doing, but just start out by sitting up straight, and we'll do maybe a 5-minute meditation on the Four Noble Truths. We won't go on too long. So all Buddhist traditions All Buddhist traditions teach these four noble truths, these four truths that are realized by what they call Arya beings, beings that have seen reality directly. And the first one is the truth of dukkha, that unsatisfactoriness is normal. It is normal. It is normal to have problems. And if we don't recognize that we're suffering, we have no motivation to practice. We don't have any motivation to practice. So we need to look at, I have anxiety issues, I have depression issues, I have worry issues, I have insecurity issues. I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not enough. You know, we all have these kinds of thoughts of insecurity from time to time. That's a kind of suffering. We don't think of it as suffering, but it's a mental suffering. The mind is not at peace. There's no tranquility in the mind when we're having that kind of thought. And then we talked about how, you know, even the most pleasurable experiences ultimately come to an end. And because we cling to the pleasure and it comes to an end, we suffer. And we think, well, that's not suffering, but it is a kind of mental dissatisfaction. It's a kind of mental pain. When we look at it, it's painful to cling to something and lose it, or to cling to something, you know, that we enjoy or that we want, and then to have it disappear. And then eventually to just, you know, to cling to our lives and have that go away. The ultimate kind of loss. And then the third one we talked about was pervasive suffering, where we're like a magnet. We're caught in, you know, those of you who've seen at the center of the wheel of life, we're caught in this process of uncontrolled causation. We don't have much control over our mind at all. And again, the Buddha is pointing this out, not to depress us, but to show us what the human condition is, the condition of all living beings, and to say, hey, look, recognize this. Recognize it, acknowledge it, because this is what we can grow beyond with effort. With effortful practice. And then we talked about the second cause was the cause of suffering. So the first two are sort of describing the human predicament, isn't it? The cause of suffering is like anger and hatred, fear, jealousy, pride. I mean, they say there are 84,000 delusions. Those are just five. And we can add to that list quite easily. So there are so many delusions that plant seeds in the mind stream, and they lead to actions of verbal and physical actions too that plant seeds in the mind stream that ripen into future suffering. And we don't want suffering. Nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants to be happy. So, you know, here's where, again, some faith in the Buddha and his teachings is necessary just to go to the next step, which is this claim that we can stop our suffering. And one of the things that helped my mind was when I began to understand emptiness a little bit intellectually and realized that this misperception of reality that we call ignorance is the cause of anger, is the cause of fear, is the cause of jealousy and pride and all the destructive mental states. So if we can cut the tap root of of ignorance, if we can cut that tap root through our practices, we can stop suffering altogether. And that's called nirvana. Nirvana means complete cessation of suffering. Complete cessation of suffering. Imagine what that might be like. Just imagine what that might be like. And then the path, again, ethics, so important for our meditation practice in particular, because if we live an unethical lifestyle, our meditation practice is doomed. We'll never be able to get deeply into any subject because we'll always be distracted by our regrets. So ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And then again, we talked about the way we package it in Buddhism, as the renunciation and bodhicitta and the wisdom of emptiness. And the Lam Rim, which is these meditations that the Thupten Chodron is guiding you through, that is the Lam Rim. That is the path. She's guiding you through every basic meditation on the path. And, that's what Buddha Dharma is all about, is to be able to do those practices and see a shift in our mind in a positive direction. And when we can do that, when we can move our mind in a positive direction, then we can begin to help others. In the beginning, maybe baby steps, but with time, more and more able to benefit others. And then eventually, becoming a Buddha, eliminating all of our faults and developing all of our good qualities, fully develop compassion, fully develop wisdom, fully develop power, and fully develop skillful means, which means knowing exactly what to do in any given situation to help somebody. So that's what it means to be a fully enlightened being. And it's something that we probably don't think we have the potential to do, but the Buddha's claim is we all have Buddha nature, and we all know we have a little bit of compassion, a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of power, and a little bit of skillful means, and they can be developed, they can be enhanced, they can be grown, and that's good enough for us at this point. If we don't have full faith in our potential, we can start out with just a little bit of faith in what we know to be true. And so at this point, it's when we understand the Four Noble Truths, we should try to make some sort of commitment to ourselves to study these teachings, to check it out for ourselves, to see if they're valid, and then if they are, to begin to put them into practice. Just slowly, slowly. We don't have to, you don't want to burn out. It's really good. Lama Yeshe used to say, slowly, 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 slowly. Just take it easy, dear. He knew we, as Westerners, we like quick results. We want it now. He said, just take it easy. Just practice a little bit. Moderate effort over time seems to be the best way to go. Okay, any questions about the Four Noble Truths? One of the things that I loved about Buddhism in the beginning and even now is that the Buddha said, Buddhism has always been like an invitation. You know, so it's very unusual to find somebody who's a big proselytizer of Buddhism. But it's like the Buddha was, you know, he was like, come and see for yourself. Come check it out for yourself. See if it works. You know, look at your life through the lenses of the Buddha Dharma. See if the teachings are valid from your experience. And if they are, then put them into practice. It is so simple. Just check it out. But he said, check it out like somebody who's assaying gold would, you know, they would cut it into little pieces and pour acid on it and all different ways to make sure it really is gold. He really invited us to look at the teachings critically and the practices and see if they're valid. Do they benefit our minds? Do they benefit our relationships? Just not only with ourselves, but with others. Something good to think about, I think. So why don't we go ahead, any other questions before we wrap it up?
Feel free to unmute and ask if you have a question.
Hi, Don. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jeff. Not Jeff. So much a question as just sort of reiterate what Don said from a personal point of view. When I first began to meditate, the truth of suffering became very apparent to me. Basically, you know, I would sit there and I would notice all these thoughts that I was having and, you know, I felt like I was going crazy. And I was working construction at the time, and so I might have all these crazy thoughts about, oh, I want to shoot my boss with a nail gun and hit this other guy with a hammer. And, you know, it was really sort of violent stuff, and I'm sort of a nice guy most of the time. And I didn't really recognize that, you know, I was having, you know, what we would label as, you know, like a homicidal maniac sort of thoughts. And so I talked to Venerable Rabina about this, and some of you guys have met her. And I said, Venerable, I did what you asked. I sit still and I close my eyes and I just pay attention to what's going on inside. And there's all these crazy things. And she just laughed at me, of course. And she said, you know, Jeff, you're not going crazy. All of those thoughts were already there. And all of these sort of things were already happening. You just weren't aware of them. And so you just sort of turned up the volume on them when you closed your eyes and decided to sit. And that helped me a lot because in the beginning, when I first started meditating, I thought it was making me worse, right? And it really wasn't. I was just had to become aware of this suffering, this dukkha, stress, you know, whatever neurotic stuff was going on in my head, and become familiar with it and know it for what it is. And nobody else could do that for me, right? So Don can talk about it theoretically, or I can tell you about my experience or whatever.
Right.
But it has to happen authentically for a person to feel it themselves, to know what it is. Otherwise, we're just, you know, the words are just words. You have to authentically feel it yourself.
Yeah, what you just said is
what I'm saying is if anybody's joining this class and they're meditating and they think that the class is making them crazy, it doesn't. Right.
Well, you know, this what you're saying is a great point. And
years ago, and now I'm much happier.
I'm sorry.
It really worked.
It really worked. Okay, thank you.
I'm going to mute myself now because I'm not the teacher. I just wanted to tell everybody that what you're saying is the truth, that it's legit. I've been through the truth of suffering.
Yeah, well, we're all doing it all the time, really, right? But the point you just made is so important, because in the beginning, when you start meditating, most meditators begin to, they think they're getting worse for the very reason that you said, because now we're actually paying attention to that internal dialogue that's always been there. But now we're listening to it and we're appalled at what's going on. And then gradually with practice and with some effort and study and so forth, you know, gradually able to unravel it and it'll settle down. They usually use the example of the wild elephant of the mind and tether. If you had a wild elephant and you had this giant pole in the ground and you tethered that elephant's leg to that pole, in the beginning, what would he do? He'd be pulling and struggling and trying to get away. But gradually what will happen is the elephant will settle down, and because he realizes he can't get free. He's got a chain around his ankle. He's tethered to a pole that's not coming out of the ground, and he'll settle down. And the very same thing happens in meditation for people that push through those beginning tough times where you feel like you're getting worse. So thank you for bringing that up. That's a great point. All right. Well, let's use this. So thank you, everyone, for showing up. And let's do the dedication verses now. And then, actually, Linda, do you want to go ahead and talk about the meditations? If you're using children's guided meditations, you remember the ones that I mentioned?
Yeah, so, and I'll post that in the homework.
Okay.
But they are B6, B7, C4, and D1. You had mentioned B8, but I didn't see a B8. There's not a B8. So B6, 7, C4, D1, and that'll be posted in the homework. I'll post it online shortly after class tonight.
Yep. So let's do the dedication verses, and again, this is just a Buddhist a practice that we train ourselves to do whenever we do, particularly when we're doing something that is virtuous. You know, Dharma practices like this, that where we have planted seeds of virtue, and we want to seal these virtuous seeds that have been planted in our garden of our mind. We want to seal them. We want these seeds to not only ripen in our happiness, but in our ability to be able to help others, and our ability to develop all the different aspects and qualities of an enlightened being. So we're dedicating our efforts tonight not only to our own happiness but to all living beings. We want to think about that as we read these words together. May all beings everywhere, plagued by suffering of body and mind, attain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain. Until then, may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So have a great week, everybody, and we'll see you next Monday.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Don. Thank you. Thanks, Linda.
Bye. Thank you, Linda.
Bye. Sharing, Jeff.
Have a good week.
You too.
I'm checking out here.
Thanks very much, Don.
You're welcome.
Good week.
You too. Thank you.
And thank you, Linda.
Thank you.